The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
In America, if you lose, you accept the results. You follow the Constitution. You try again. You don't call facts fake and then try to bring down the American experiment just because you're unhappy. That's not statesmanship.
And there is the fake president yesterday in Philadelphia, of all places. Philadelphia, a hot spot for fraud and election steals for decades, in fact. It goes far beyond what happened on November 3rd. But there he is talking about, of all things, the Constitution and these states. Well, he even mentioned the state audits that are happening in Arizona. And he's worried now about Pennsylvania because he has Senator Mastriano and others calling for an Arizona-style full forensic audit. Georgia, already you've got a judge there that says that 147,000 ballots should be unsealed. There was the story on Friday. This is at the Federalist. New evidence indicates enough illegal votes in Georgia to tip the 2020 results. This is just people that, according to Georgia's own records, they filed for they moved, basically. They had a different address, different county. And yet these votes still showed up, more than 10,000. And the fake president there won, quote unquote, he won Georgia by, I think it was 12,000 votes. This is a worried fake administration. And there he was yesterday, angry. There he was, sounding desperate. There he was, really fearful of what's coming and pleading with people, please accept my presidency. Please accept the fact that I'm legitimate. So said Joe Biden yesterday in Philadelphia. Welcome back, by the way, to the Trumpet Daily. I'm Stephen Flurry, your host. Thanks to Richard Palmer for filling in yesterday. As so many of you know, we've got our summer educational program going on even at the moment. In fact, just moments ago, I was in the gymnasium, the John Amos Fieldhouse, enjoying a basketball class. So it's not the typical way that I prepare for a radio program, but I was able to put in a little preparation before the class. And so hopefully today we can catch you up on some of the latest developments, particularly this speech that Joe Biden gave in Philadelphia. They are scared, the radical left. They're being exposed. And from what we're hearing coming out of Arizona and how that what the official election tabulation was and then what they actually counted in the full forensic audit, they don't match up. So Arizona's going to be the first domino to fall. And Georgia soon thereafter. And then if Pennsylvania's in the mix, I mean, that's it. I mean, that turns the entire election. How it's going to play out, when it's going to play out, there's still lots, I guess, to wonder about. But if it's nothing but a fraudit, as the left has been saying, if it's nothing but, you know, these conspiracy theorists, the ninja people, if that's all there is to it, then why? Why? You get, I think it was President Trump who said, you know, why does he get on beautiful Air Force One and fly to Philadelphia, the site of the crime, in the case of that county, one of the crimes? Why go to Philadelphia and desperately plead with people, please accept my presidency. Please accept me as legitimate. He knows, and those around him, they know. They've been exposed. They know that the fraud is being exposed. This is from Donald Trump yesterday. He said, Joe Biden is going to Pennsylvania today in a rush in order to stop the forensic audit that the Pennsylvania Republican Senate is in the process of doing. It says Philadelphia was a cesspool of corruption, which will soon be revealed by the audit. And so there he is. He's trying to stop yet another audit from going forward. And a majority of Americans want this. They like the idea of audits. Just like they like the ideas of these state legislatures passing laws saying, you know what, you need to prove you need to prove who you are when you're voting, whether in person or by absentee ballot. You need to have some kind of voter identification. There's Democrats that are actually proudly maintaining the fact that they're against showing any voter ID whatsoever. They don't have the majority support. These state legislatures, you've got the Democrats in Texas just fleeing the scene, basically. Not carrying out their constitutional duties. Joe Biden's talking about the Constitution. Oh, you mean like a state determining how and when and the laws and the rules of an election? That's constitutional. That's a state's constitutional duty. And then here are these Democrats. All that they can do is flee the state, throw a little temper tantrum, try to delay the process. And Joe Biden there in Philadelphia talking about how this is an assault on democracy. He's the one assaulting it. This is from yesterday in Philadelphia, clip two.
There's an unfolding assault taking place in America today, an attempt to suppress and subvert the right to vote and fair and free elections, an assault on democracy, an assault on liberty, an assault on who we are as Americans.
Isn't that rich? I mean, here they got away with all this cheating, all of these fake ballots. And the states, of course, the reason all these states are passing the laws is because they know. They know. They're like, we've got to get it back to pre-COVID standards. Otherwise, this is just going to happen again. And it's going to happen in more places. If they get away with this, it's not going to be just Fulton County in Philadelphia and Maricopa County or Clark County in Nevada. It's going to happen everywhere. In fact, you've got some state, even Oklahoma. There's Republicans in the state legislature right here in this state, a state that's red through and through. And even in Oklahoma, they're calling for audits. Pretty amazing developments. You can see why the fake administration is so concerned, so worried. This is from Conservative Treehouse. It says the speech Joe Biden delivered Tuesday in Philadelphia was not the rant of a righteous or confident man. Instead, the speech was a bitter, angry, and divisive plea for help from those extreme leftists who supported his installation. You guys installed me. You've got to support me now. You've got to fight for me now. These government agencies that have been weaponized, the DOJ, the FBI, I mean, you've got to put a stop to these fraudits. This is, again, another clip from yesterday, clip three.
The assault on free and fair elections is just such a threat, literally. I've said it before. We're facing the most significant test of our democracy since the Civil War. That's not hyperbole. Since the Civil War. The Confederates, back then, never breached the Capitol, as insurrectionists did on January the 6th. I'm not saying this to alarm you. I'm saying this because you should be alarmed.
Nice. I'm not saying this to alarm you. I'm saying this to alarm you. That's the insider-in-chief. The insider who's saying, basically, Republicans, they're now the Confederacy. They've got to be stopped. That's someone that's calling for war, basically. It's even worse. January 6th. There they go again, the so-called insurrection. It's all part of the same scam, the same fraud, isn't it? They desperately needed an insurrection on January the 6th to use that as an excuse to just move on And to not count or recount or to have any kind of forensic examination of anything. Because after all, when they called for that on January the 6th, look at what happened. Look at what happened. I mean, they stormed the Capitol, those FBI agents. They stormed the Capitol, Antifa. They need that, just like they needed the mail-in ballots. Just like they needed the COVID-19. They had to have that as a pretext to just send out tens of millions of ballots. And now you've got Georgia. You've got all these election officials that are quite concerned. They're backtracking quite a lot, Raffensperger and his bunch down in Georgia, because they know. They thought, just sweep it under the rug. Tell everybody there's nothing to worry about here. There's nothing to see here. They didn't think anybody would actually go back and look at the evidence, examining all the receipts. They didn't think that would happen. And now that it's happening, they're trying to get on the right side of history, some of those weak Republicans. But the communists coming from the Democrat Party, they're there screaming bloody murder, saying it's racist. Listen again to Joe Biden from yesterday, clip 4.
They want to make it so hard and inconvenient that they hope people don't vote at all. That's what this is about. This year alone, 17 states have enacted, not just proposed, but enacted 28 new laws to make it harder for Americans to vote. Not to mention, and catch this, nearly 400 additional bills Republican members of the state legislatures are trying to pass. The 21st century Jim Crow assault is real. It's unrelenting. And we're going to challenge it vigorously.
Here again, statements from a desperate man. He knows his fake presidency is at stake here. So there he is, calling up Jim Crow. Yeah, here we go again. It's racism, of course. People making it harder for individuals to vote by saying, you've got to show ID. What they're actually doing is just making it a little bit harder to cheat these states. I like how he talks about these laws being passed by state legislatures as if that's somehow Jim Crow or if that's somehow illegal. This is their constitutional responsibility and duty. Conservative Treehouse says the need for control is a reaction to fear. That fear was what Joe Biden displayed above all other attributes, a fear that more American people will begin to see the false construct of his installation, a fear that those who perpetrated the fraud of his election will be exposed because the scale of their manipulation is far too great to continue hiding. Here again, the scale, it's far too great for them to continue to hide it. He said at one point yesterday, he said there were 150 people who voted. And of course, he meant 150 million. But President Trump was right to point out, well, I got 75 million and he's supposed to have gotten 81 million. So that's more like 156. Are they already conceding that 6 million that he supposedly won by? Here's Joe Biden making that slip up yesterday with respect to how many voted, clip 6.
In 2020, more people voted in America than ever in the history of America, in the middle of a once-in-a-century pandemic. All told, more than 150 Americans of every age, of every race, of every background, exercise their right to vote.
And then President Trump said, they're already conceding the 6 million, it looks like. He's making mistakes. He's desperate. He's angry. He's trying to drum up support in Philadelphia, of all places. It says here at the article I was quoting, the fear that a small amount of actual investigation with more audits looming will reveal how a few key corrupt counties coordinated a massive election fraud. Philadelphia County, Pennsylvania, the location of Tuesday's sanctimonious diatribe delivered by a naked emperor, was the location of the largest fraud. See, it just gets worse. It's bad enough in Maricopa. Then you go on to Fulton County, even worse. Then you get up to Philadelphia County, and that's perhaps worst of all. Maybe some in Detroit would argue that. But it's just going to get worse as this proceeds. It says here, the angry speech was full of projection, denial, and extreme defensiveness. It says, yes, the need for control is a reaction to fear, and it was very obvious Joe Biden feels the control is slipping away. It's very obvious from that speech yesterday that he feels the control is slipping away, and so there he is. There he is saying these voter integrity laws, that's racist, that's Jim Crow. And look, we've already had the audits. He actually talked about the audits in his speech yesterday, which is only going to give it more legitimacy, particularly when you've got 55% of Americans saying, yeah, I like the idea of audits. I want to make sure it's legit. Well, he's talking about audits, and we're about to hear from some of these states. Washington Examiner had a piece on Tucker Carlson. It says here, Fox News host Tucker Carlson said he will examine new evidence of voter fraud in Fulton County, Georgia on his show Wednesday. So I guess that's tonight. As I've said over the weeks, Fox News, I mean, they have probably been weakest of all, at least with respect to the election steal. Even going back to election night and what they did, calling Arizona at something like 10 or 11 p.m. at night when it was just razor close. And you have these execs, it went all the way up to Rupert Murdoch. He said, yeah, go ahead and give Arizona to Biden as if it's his to give. What about the people who actually voted? What about all the discrepancies now that have been discovered in the forensic audit? They're going to have to answer for this. That coverage and the positions they've maintained for months now. And you got Tucker Carlson, the most popular commentator on Fox at night. And he now announcing that he's going to look into the election fraud. This is not going away. That's why you have Joe Biden getting on Air Force One. That's why you have him showing up in Philadelphia, the site of the crime. To say, look, help me. Help, you installed me. The radical left installed me. Now make sure you defend my illegitimate presidency. That's the message coming through loud and clear from Joe Biden's message yesterday. It says here in this Examiner piece, Tucker told his audience Monday that he has not done many segments on voter fraud since January, which included the U.S. Capitol riot and President Joe Biden's inauguration, noting how there have been multiple unfounded claims. But Carlson also said there is good reason to explore some of the allegations more than 8 months after the November election. So now here's Tucker. He's returning to the steal, covering it now, maybe for the first time. He's done it in an indirect way here and there. It says here, there are some very irresponsible claims. Well, further on, it says, the election may be long over, but former President Donald Trump and his allies still insist the contest was stolen despite assurances by federal, state, and local officials. The officials, they're there to assure us everything was perfect. There was no evidence of widespread fraud in 2020. It says, what Carlson says on his show will likely make waves as he attracts an average audience of more than 3 million viewers each day and prompts several media commentary pieces. Most recently, he ignited an entire news cycle with his National Security Agency spying allegations. In other words, he's a pretty powerful voice, an influential voice. It'll be interesting to see what he has to say this evening on his program. I mentioned that case in Texas where they want to pass laws basically saying you need voter ID if you're going to vote in Texas. And so the Democrats responded to that by just leaving the state legislature and I think flying off to Washington, D.C. just to try to delay the process. Here they were on the state capitol, these Texas Democrats, just yesterday singing this cringeworthy tune, clip one.
I turn it back over to you for the questions, and thank you very much for all that you and all of your colleagues are doing here today.
Thank you. We will overcome. We will overcome. We will overcome someday. Deep in our hearts, I do believe we will overcome someday.
Oh, brother. there they are. It's racist to show a voter ID. It's racist to expect people to show your that, as several pointed out on social media, for them to get on a plane, even to fly to D.C., they had to show ID just to fly on a commercial airline. Maybe it was a private aircraft. I don't know. But chances are they had to show ID. But there they are singing, "We will overcome." We'll overcome Jim Crow and all these racist actions, expecting Texas voters to show their ID. What a gimmick. What a gimmick. It's like they're a circus act. Everything's happening in a legit way. These are how laws pass in state by state. But see, they're reacting like the little children that they are, little tantrums, to try to keep any kind of voter integrity in place for future elections and to try to keep any kind of forensic audit from happening in these states, these counties, where there was obvious fraud. One quick follow-up to what we covered on Monday with respect to the vaccine and the side effects now that are mounting. You see it in every Western nation. You see it in the United States. You see it in Australia. You see it. We had that article at the Trumpet.com website on Monday talking about some of the VAERS website and other websites that track these violent reactions to the vaccine, even death. Even death. This was the New York Times on Monday. It says here, federal regulators concluded that the risk of developing the syndrome was low and that the benefits of the vaccine still strongly outweigh it. This is in response to the FDA saying that it's going to attach a warning of rare nerve syndrome to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. This is now the New York Times. And yet no coverage of this that I know of in the nightly talk shows later that evening. But even the New York Times acknowledging that, yeah, there's a few problems with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It says here, the Food and Drug Administration is planning to warn that Johnson & Johnson's coronavirus vaccine can lead to an increased risk of a rare neurological condition known as Guillain-Barré syndrome, another setback for a vaccine that has largely been sidelined in the United States. Yet another setback for these vaccines that haven't been tested for the most part and have not been approved by the FDA. It's a total experiment. A total experiment. Listen to what Senator Dick Durbin had to say. The silent part came out loud in this statement from the Senate just the other day, clip eight.
There are two hosts of programs on Fox primetime that can only be characterized as anti-vax quacks. I'm referring, of course, to Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham. They have been spreading what I consider to be irresponsible information about vaccines across America and about the effort of this nation to deal with them. Here's the reality. We have millions who've died across the world by this vaccine. We may never have an accurate count.
Here's the reality. Millions have died from the vaccine around the world. He didn't obviously mean to say that. But that's probably the extent of it. When you add up nation after nation after nation, all the nations around the world, after it's all said and done,
As we said early on, the cure, worse than the disease. This is man's bungled attempt to eliminate disease, to eliminate sickness. And look at how much more sickness and disease we're bringing on ourselves. So much so now that you've got even the New York Times admitting that, yeah, there's some pretty big problems with Johnson & Johnson. When we come back, we'll give you a Bible study on the subject of, well, not to give it away. It's a subject that should be, as my father has said, it should be your primary focus in life. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. If you'd like to submit some feedback to the show, you can email the program, td@thetrumpet.com. That's td@thetrumpet.com. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily.
Breathing out, breathing in, more precious than it's ever been. We can't take it for granted. Never in our lifetimes has that fact been clearer, that precious breath of life. It might start to shorten. It might struggle. It might cease. How can it be protected? How can it be prolonged? How can it be saved? And what is the purpose anyway? What is the purpose of human life? What should you use that breath for? Most of us turn to doctors. It's a reflex, but it's becoming more and more clear that the medical industry does not have all the answers. It can be amazingly helpful, but can it actually heal? Is this the place to turn for healing after all? The human body, human breath, human life was designed, powered, preserved. It was created. Who made it? With something so important as your life, you need to know the creator of life. The Plain Truth About Healing by Herbert W. Armstrong will show you from your Bible the answers to the questions even most Christians are afraid to ask. Is the day of miracles past? Does the living God heal sickness? Did God raise up medical science for our day? What is the role of doctors? You can have not only sound health, but a sound mind. Go to thetrumpet.com and search The Plain Truth About Healing by Herbert W. Armstrong.
The Trumpet Daily.
A couple of the books that we've been promoting to the teenagers at our summer camp. One of them, our own, Former Prophets, written by my father. Another one called I Dare You, which really does encourage the young people to be proactive and to, as well as we heard in a lecture yesterday, to cause good action, to cause good things to happen by taking the initiative and, like Mr. Armstrong said, setting goals and putting forth a plan to carry out those goals. But coming back to the Former Prophets book, so many examples there for the young people to look at and to emulate. King David, there's an entire chapter in Former Prophets with respect to David and his life. But before that, you get into this this lengthy chapter on the prophet Samuel as well. And seeing the way he established a close and intimate relationship with God at such an early age, even as a young teenager. You can see this in 1 Samuel 3. Verse 1, it says, "And the child Samuel ministered unto the Eternal before Eli." He was just a child, and he was ministering unto the Eternal. He was doing God's work as a 13-year-old, perhaps. It says, "And the word of the Eternal was precious in those days. There was no open vision." So God's truth had virtually disappeared. This is coming right off of the end of the period of Judges. Over four centuries of God's truth being cast to the ground, basically. God's truth being unavailable. What a miserable period, the period of the judges. Every man doing what seemed right in his own eyes. But God had a plan, a plan of restoration and glory. And it started with this prophet, this young prophet, Samuel, ministering unto the Eternal before Eli. It says in verse 2, "And it came to pass at that time, when Eli was laid down in his place, and his eyes began to wax dim, that he could not see. And ere the lamp of God went out in the temple of the Eternal, where the ark of God was," it says, "and Samuel was laid down to sleep." So God here is, he's about to move his lamp. He's basically about to move to Samuel. Samuel's the one that's serving me and ministering to me, unto me. This is quite an example for our young people, as I've said. God will work with any life, young, old, anything in between, if we'll just work at our relationship with Him. I mean, that's really, as I said the other day to the campers, to the whole camp, in fact, when you consider just how much, there's fun from, you know, there's a 12-hour block each day where it's exercise, it's socializing, it's meal time, it's a little bit of instruction, it's obviously a lot of instruction with respect to activities, sports, and so on. But the whole day is built around what happens before you show up at the dining hall for exercise and breakfast. Before that, you're waking up not a minute before you leave the door, but even hours before that comes around, so that you can draw near to your dorm, and so that you can draw near to God, and so that you can get in prayers and Bible study. That's the foundation of this camp. It's all built around the prayer and the Bible study time. And of course, some are more advanced in that than others, but still, everyone comes here to learn how to do that in a better way. Something we all have to constantly work at. Verse 4, it says, "And the Eternal called Samuel, and he answered, 'Here am I.' And he ran to Eli and said, 'Here am I, for you called me.' And he said, 'I called not. Lie down again.' And he went to lay down, and the Eternal called yet again." And so this sequence happens over and over. Samuel thought it was Eli calling for him. And so he was very responsive. He ran in there. He wanted to assist Eli. And over time, Eli realized, I think God's trying to get through to you. I think God's trying to get your attention. Eli perceived that the Eternal had called the child. That's at the end of verse 8. And again, it notes that he was just a child. What a remarkable exchange here. Why would God be so interested in the thoughts and the actions and the responsibilities of a child? Verse 9, it says, "Therefore Eli said unto Samuel, 'Go lie down, and it shall be, if he calls you, that you shall say, "Speak, Lord, for your servant hears." So Samuel went and lay down in his place, and the Eternal came and stood and called, as at the other time, 'Samuel, Samuel!' And then Samuel answered, 'Speak, for your servant hears.'" Now, my father draws attention to this beautiful attitude in that former prophet's chapter on the prophet Samuel. He said, "This is the attitude we all need when God speaks to us. When God speaks, we need to listen up and say, 'Go ahead, for your servant hears. I'm listening. Go ahead, I'm listening. What is it you need of me? What is it you expect of me?'" Verse 11, it says, "And the Eternal said to Samuel, 'Behold, I will do a thing in Israel, at which both the ears of everyone that hears it shall tingle.'" This is from the former prophet's book. My father said, "God called Samuel to reveal truth to him. He began to give new revelation, something extremely rare in Israel. God began by explaining how he would punish Eli and his family because his sons made themselves vile and he restrained them not." So this was not just revelation, it was also strong correction for Eli's household. And God's delivering it through this child, this teenager. How difficult would this mission have been? He was ministering to God, yes, but also to Eli. And now God says to Samuel, I want you to go and deliver this message to Eli, the house of Eli. That couldn't have been easy. And yet, Samuel did not shy away from it. Of course, there was a point in this, I won't read all the verses, but even Eli insisted, look, you give me exactly what God gave to you. Tell me what he said. And so Samuel did do that. And it was very corrective for Eli and his household. But notice again about this unique child, this teenager, this 13-year-old. Verse 19 says, and Samuel grew, and the Eternal was with him, and did let none of his words fall to the ground. Here again, my father really points to the beautiful attitude that he had, telling God, yes, I'm here, I'm listening. What would you have me to do? And then here it says that Samuel would not let the words of God fall to the ground. He wanted to consume all of the thoughts, all of the words, all of the actions of God himself. That's why Samuel grew, as it says there in verse 19. Samuel was the solution to the dreadful period of Judges. God was in the midst of a great restoration through this child, a child who happened to be a very courageous teenager, who relayed everything God had told him to say about Eli and his family. And then here in verse 19, as we just read, you see the source of Samuel's strength. You see why he was a young man of upstanding character, because he was grounded in God's word. As I say, everything in the camp schedule here at SEP, it revolves around this. It revolves around the spiritual foundation, getting established on that right foundation, using prayer and study as those great building blocks that they are with respect to this unique young man, this courageous young man, it says in former prophets. He was only a teenager, yet he let none of God's words fall to the ground, not even one. That's a marvelous description of a great prophet of God. He was hungering and thirsting for righteousness, so much that in spirit, he got it all. He got it all. And God loved that attitude. God loved it. Samuel's attitude, his approach to true education, this is what empowered that young man's life. And this is the attitude we need more of. Every day, making it a goal to not let a word, not even a word, fall to the ground, but to have that hunger and thirst for righteousness, to have that hunger and that thirst for God's word, for God's truth. We've enjoyed a forum or a Bible lecture on the subject of our royal Bible study or our royal attitude when it comes to Bible study. Think of the Bereans there in Acts 17, that example, where God points out that they were more noble than some of their neighbors because they searched the scriptures daily to prove God's truth. These were noble Bible studiers. And as we've heard earlier at this camp, we need to be on fire for our royal education. We need to be on fire for learning and understanding this precious foundation of all knowledge, that is the Holy Bible, hungering and thirsting for every word, and also spending time with our Father in heaven in prayer, not just study alone, but prayer, fervent prayer, the effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. This is a quote from Royal Vision or the magazine, going back to 1998, so this is probably one of the best-known quotes that my father has penned, because it's been repeated so many times over the last two decades or so. But he said, our primary focus in life must be on how we talk to God in prayer. That's our number one priority. That's how we grow in God's family. So that's got to be our primary focus, how we talk to God in prayer. You think of all the other activities that we can get caught up in during the course of a day. And when things don't go well, it always traces back to the fact that we're really not paying enough attention to the primary focus. We're not putting the highest value on our prayer time, fervent, energetic prayers to God. That's our most important activity every day. Nothing is more important. And as I say, the effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man, it really does produce. It really does promote growth and development. There's so many wonderful examples in the autobiography of Herbert Armstrong and just the approach that he had to his prayer life. There's obviously great examples, as Brad McDonald brought out earlier at this camp, about his study, particularly his conversion, where he was studying late into the night at the Portland Library and coming back home tired, but yet still just absolutely almost obsessed with just getting through God's truth, teaching, learning at the feet of God. This was early on in Mr. Armstrong's ministry or his converted life, going back to the 1920s. There's another instance, though, in the autobiography where he points to it, Mr. Armstrong does, as really the beginning of the Philadelphia era of God's church, the beginning of God's work in these last days. It started with a public Bible lecture at the Fear Butte School there in the Willamette Valley in Oregon. And it was just a little ways away from the Fisher Farm where he had been staying. And he says in the autobiography, "But if small," the beginning of the Philadelphia era of God's work, "if small, it started with a burst of energy and inspiration. First, it started with intensive and earnest private prayer." It says, "To the rear of the Fisher Farm was a fair-sized hill. Running over this hilltop for exercise, I discovered a rock about 14 inches high. It was in a secluded spot. It came to mind how Jesus had dismissed the multitudes and gone up into a mountain apart to pray, alone to God." Mr. Armstrong says, "I dropped to my knees before this rock, which seemed just the right height to kneel before, and began praying earnestly for the success of the meetings." It says, "It became sort of a daily pilgrimage during my stay at the Fishers to this, which became my prayer rock. I'm sure that I drank in much energy, spiritual strength, and inspiration at that prayer rock." He was on fire, Herbert Armstrong was. He was on fire for his relationship with God. He drank in much energy, much strength. You can read, by the way, about other examples in the same section of the autobiography where he was off with, you know, more lukewarm Laodicean-type ministers who weren't really praying, not like this. And the success of their campaigns, well, there wasn't much. But this one, where he was more on his own, he was responsible for what was happening at the Fear Butte School. This is how he started his day. And then, as you read in the autobiography account, you see that God blessed it. There was actually fruit that came from that campaign, that Bible lecture. This is what Mr. Armstrong had to say. He said, "I had come to realize that the success of any campaign depended more on the amount and earnestness of prayer behind such a campaign than on the oratory or eloquence of the speaker." See, the results, it depended more on the success of the prayers being offered than it did on the preaching or maybe the venue or maybe the charisma of the speaker, whatever it might be. We want to get God involved. We want to bring God to the center. So here is Mr. Armstrong talking about a daily pilgrimage that he had of sorts. His energetic efforts to bring God right into the middle of that campaign. And lo and behold, God blessed it. God really did bless it. Notice Jeremiah 23. Jeremiah 23, you see this same attitude and spirit, whether it's with Samuel, the child, or Mr. Armstrong early on in his ministry. Or here's another case, Jeremiah the prophet. It says in verse 9 of Jeremiah 23, "My heart within me is broken because of the prophets. All my bones shake. I'm like a drunken man, and like a man whom wine has overcome, because the eternal and because of the words of his holiness." So here is another prophet of God talking about the kind of impact that God's truth had on him. Verse 28 further down, it says, "The prophet that has a dream, let him tell a dream. And he that has my word, let him speak my word faithfully." It says, "What is the chaff to the wheat, says the eternal." So you can see this in Samuel. I mean, he got the dream, he received the word, and he spoke it faithfully. Well, Jeremiah was the same way. And in verse 29, it says, "Is not my word like as fire, says the eternal, and like a hammer that breaks the rock in pieces?" God's word is like fire. God's spirit, it's like fire. It fires us up. There's the example in Jeremiah 20 where the prophet says, you know, I was a little discouraged. It didn't seem like the message was getting through to anyone. He was wondering if his ministry, if his work was in vain. And then the prophet says in Jeremiah 20 and verse 9, "Then I said, I will not make mention of him, nor speak any more in his name. But his word was in my heart as a burning fire shut up in my bones, and I was weary with forbearing, and I could not stay." I just couldn't stop. Humanly, he wanted to give up. He was discouraged. He said, okay, I'll not make mention of this. Fine. But then he started feeding on God's word. He wouldn't let one word drop to the ground, just like Samuel. And God's word was like a fiery furnace in Jeremiah's bones. This is how we get fired up for our royal future. This is how we show some energy in serving God. Notice what it says in Mark 1 and verse 35. It says, "And in the morning, rising up a great while before the day, he went out," speaking of Jesus, "he went out and departed into a solitary place and there prayed." See, this is just the way of great men and women of the Bible. In the morning, you know how many demands Jesus had on his time. He couldn't get away from the multitudes. They'd chase him down. They'd run along the shoreline following him, following his boat. And this is what he had to do to make sure he got in his time with God. It says, "In the morning, rising up a great while before day." Now, Jesus had to get his physical rest in as well, so I'm sure he was going to bed at a decent hour. But he got up early, and he started praying to God earnestly, fervently. And those prayers, they really got results. James 5 and verse 16, it says, "Confess your faults one to another and pray one for another that you may be healed," it says. It says, "The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much." So here is another disciple of Christ, an apostle of God, advocating for diligent, energetic prayer. This is effectual prayer that gets results. This is the kind of prayer that will energize your life. This is the kind of prayer that will give your life direction. This is the kind of prayer that's not easy. Nowhere in the Bible does it say it's easy to really pour your heart into prayers to God. But boy, it really does produce. If you make this your primary focus each day, your number one activity, this will revolutionize your life. It says in verse 17, Elijah was a man subject to like passions as we are, and he prayed earnestly, and that it might not rain, and it rained not on the earth by the space of 3 years and 6 months. And then verse 18 says, and he prayed again, and the heaven gave rain, and the earth brought forth her fruit. It says there about Elijah, look, he was flesh and blood. He had similar desires and drives like us. So what made him so special in God's eyes? Well, among other things, look at his prayer life. Wow. Look at the way he approached his prayers. He cried out to God, and God would hear him and respond. Notice what Herbert Armstrong wrote. This is from 1980. He said, "As of the moment I write, there is not one thing I have had to rely on God for and ask him for in prayer, for myself and family or the wonderful work of his, which he has committed to me that has not been answered." There's not one thing he hasn't answered. There's not one thing he's ignored. He's always there. He's always there responding to bold and courageous, energetic, fervent prayers. Now, it's different when it's just kind of a half-hearted, sleepy time prayer. But when you're praying in a way where it's like a fiery furnace in your heart, that's the kind of prayer that really does generate a strong response from God our Father. That's the example that Jesus set for us. He too was a man of flesh and blood. He was obviously God in the flesh. But as we saw, I mean, he got up a great while before the day to make sure he talked to God. This is Hebrews 5:7. It says, "Who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard in that he feared." So Jesus, too, he prayed so boldly, so energetically, so fervently at one point that he sweat great drops of blood. You can see that in the Gospels. He was praying his way through the challenges and the trials and the tests that he had to face. Christ's primary focus in life was in how he talked to God in prayer. That was his primary focus. Shouldn't that be ours then? Shouldn't our primary focus, if we're following in the steps of Christ, shouldn't we value an energetic prayer life the same way that Jesus did? Of course we should. The problem is we get lazy and selfish. We're distracted. We're tired. Hebrews 4, verse 14, it says, "Seeing then that we have a great high priest that has passed into the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession. For we have not an high priest which cannot be touched or sympathize with the feelings of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted, like as we are, yet without sin." We've got this high priest, right? Christ, obviously, at the throne of God, God the Father. And it says in verse 16, "Let us therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." Go boldly before God's throne. You can go together with Jesus Christ before the throne room of God. And then we've got Christ there as our advocate, our high priest, beseeching God even for us. Do you go before God in prayer with this kind of bold, decisive action? This is the kind of action that really does cause a lot of good things to happen. Make it your most important activity every day. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We're already putting the finishing touches on another hour of broadcasting here at thetrumpet.com/live. If you'd like to submit some feedback, you can write us td@thetrumpet.com. We thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.